Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You know, for many physicians, when a patient presents with a health concern, a provider takes a history of the problem, kind of getting an idea of his account of the complaint, or when it started, aggravating factors, alleviating factors, the timing, severity, and so forth. And often, it's like meeting someone for the first time or somebody you know in the past. You recognize that person or that problem, and the history goes a long way into making any diagnosis. However, often an exam is also done to evaluate the physical findings, and maybe depending on the condition, some lab or imaging may be done, often to help or maybe just to verify the diagnosis. However, ophthalmologists, eye specialists, the exam of the eye is often where the diagnosis is made, or at least that's my thought. This is because the eye is often affected directly or indirectly by an enormous number of diseases and can be examined in great detail. So today's guest is Anchorage ophthalmologist Dr. Kelly Lorenz. And the two of us decided this would be a good topic. So we're looking at what the eye exam can tell us about health and disease. Kelly, welcome once again to Line One.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a real pleasure to have you come back. So those of you who are listening today, you can reach us directly with your questions and comments throughout the next hour. If you live in Anchorage, the phone number is 550-8433. 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And for our listeners that want to get in touch by email, it's line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Kelly, we're talking about physical findings of ears of disease today, and I mentioned at the beginning, at least as a pediatrician, probably many family practice physicians, many physicians, I'd say that making a diagnosis of a problem is about 70% history, and I'm just pulling these numbers from my experience. 20% physical exam, maybe 10% for lab, and my personal use of lab is almost always just for confirmation. All of this is kind of highly dependent on the particular problem. So was I right about ophthalmology? You guys just look at the eye and don't care what anybody has to say?
I think there is some truth in that, actually. Maybe not quite the opposite statistics, but oftentimes I can look in someone's eye and diagnose something, you know, perhaps a history they don't even know about, mm-hmm. and diagnose a new condition. And that's what makes ophthalmology so interesting.
Okay. So I want to get in, and what our plan is today is to really discuss different illnesses, different problems, and basically what's seen in the eye, where it's seen in the eye. And this is always difficult. Kelly and I may assume that everybody understands the detail of the eye exam and the anatomy, but that's not true, and this is radio, so I'm going to do the tough thing, or leave you with the tough job, trying to explain to our listeners, paint us a picture of the important details of the anatomy of the eye.
Okay, sure. Well, you may remember I like the picture of the eye very, very, very simplistically. It's kind of like a big ball, and there's stuff in the front, and there's stuff in the back. And going from the front to the back as the light enters the eye, you know, the light first enters through the cornea, the clear structure on the front of the eye that's dome-shaped. Behind the cornea, we have the aqueous humor, which is a little pocket of fluid there, and that sits right in front of the iris, the colored portion of the eye. Now, the iris has muscles in it that make the pupil get bigger and smaller, and through that pupil, right behind the iris, sits the crystalline lens of the eye. And that's a biconvex structure that's, you know, like a little ball, clear ball that helps focus light onto the back of the eye. And that lens can change shape. When we're younger, it changes shape so that we can see far away, and then we can change and see up close. But things get a little stiffer as we get older, and they can't change shape as well. And that's why we need reading glasses as we get older. Now, behind the lens sits the vitreous body. That's a clear kind of gel mass that takes up the bulk of the room inside the eye. The back layer of the eye, that's where the retina sits with its nerve cells, its ganglion cells, photoreceptor cells that detect light and dark and color and movement and transmit all that information to the optic nerve, which is connected to the back of the eye. Now, those signals are taken by the optic nerve back to the brain, way back in the back of the brain to the occipital lobe for processing.
for just a second, and maybe I could do it differently. Let's do it this way. Let's just talk about cataracts first. And what I'm trying to do is get into a little bit more detail. The anatomy can get even more interesting than just the superficial, and maybe cataracts will get us there. So let's let's start with, what is a cataract? Where do you see that? And how can you tell about different kinds of problems from just looking at those cataracts?
Yeah, a cataract is, as we get older usually, the clear lens of the eye becomes cloudier and cloudier as we get older. Now, it doesn't have to happen when we get older. We can get cataracts at different ages for different reasons. And when I look at an eye and look at the lens of the eye and the cloudiness of the eye, a cataract in a way is like a snowflake, because every pattern is different. And some of these patterns have different names to them and have different causes to them. For example, I'd say the standard type of cataract is called a nuclear sclerotic cataract. And that's just the garden variety cataract we get as we get older, where we have an overall yellowish browning of the lens. And when it gets dense enough, not enough light can make it through that lens to create a clear image on the back of the retina. And so what we do for cataract surgery is remove the natural lens of the eye and replace it with a little artificial lens. Now, there are different patterns, as I said. For example, you can have something called a posterior subcapsular cataract that is sort of like some schmutzy stuff on the back of the lens, and that is often associated with use of steroids. Somebody who's been on steroid medications for a long time may get that sort of cataract, and that can particularly cause, it can grow fast, and it can cause a lot of glare with bright lights. Diabetics get a specific type of cataract sometimes called a snowflake cataract, because of its white opacities within the lens make it look like a snowflake. People who've been electrocuted can get something called a stellate cataract, and that causes a very particular kind of star-shaped cataract. And one of my favorite cataracts, I guess I have a favorite, people with a condition called myotonic dystrophy. Sometimes people without this condition can get something called a Christmas tree cataract, because it literally looks like a Christmas tree with these little colored crystals within the cataract, and it's very, it's actually very pretty. It's kind of like, sometimes hate having to take those out.
So you can look at that cataract and often tell what the origin of it by its, where it's located in the lens, and by the how it looks to you.
Sometimes, that's right.
Trauma can do it. Does the trauma affect a different part of the lens if there's a traumatic cataract?
It depends. Trauma can definitely cause a cataract. It usually causes a very specific section of the lens to develop a cataract, you know, where that trauma took place. And it's often something called a cortical cataract can occur with trauma, which is sort of a white, opaque spoke within the lens of the eye that can be problematic for the patient. Sometimes it's not visually significant. People can live with it for a long time, though.
And as a pediatrician, I was trained, and that we were, one of the things we look for in newborns pretty quickly is just to look for a rid reflex. We're looking at the, as best we can at the eye. And there are conditions, metabolic conditions, what come to my mind, that can affect cataracts very early in life. I've never seen one of those, and it may be because the equipment I have to see cataracts is not quite the equipment that you have.
Yep, yeah. So there are cataracts that even infants can get. So it's important to look for that red reflex, because if the infant does have a cataract, it should be removed promptly to keep them from developing amblyopia.
Right. Amblyopia is a condition. We've kind of talked about this before. You get 80% of your adult head size in the first couple of years of life, and we now know there's critical periods, as I understand it, that if the neurons involved with vision are not stimulated, your brain will prune those things away, and that can, so it's a preventable cause of vision loss.
That's right.
And cataracts can be one of them. Much different vision in one eye or the other for some reason that can do it. So it's a common thing pediatricians are looking for. So while we're on that topic, what are you seeing, and what are the reasons for nearsighted, farsighted, and this crazy word that you hear all the time, astigmatism? What's going on there?
I'd say the biggest reason for whether somebody is nearsighted or farsighted or has astigmatism has to do with the overall shape of the eye, and there can be a strong genetic component to that. People that have, you know, not all eyes, let's put it this way, not all eyes are a perfect beach ball shape. They're not all perfect spheres. And so some eyes are a little longer, and you can be nearsighted with that, and some eyes are shorter, and you can be farsighted with that. astigmatism can arise from a couple different areas. I think of astigmatism in simple terms. It's an irregularity of how light enters the eye. And so if there's that irregularity there, the light's not coming to a point on the back of the retina to give you a nice sharp image. And that can arise from an irregularity of how the front of the eye is shaped, the cornea. And sometimes it can arise from a developing cataract as well, in which case we can mm-hmm. remove that when we remove the cataract.
Mm-hmm. And another thought I had put down on paper is, what about the symptom of sudden loss of vision? What would you commonly think about seeing? Where would you find those things? As somebody who's really doing pretty well but suddenly has difficulty with vision.
There are a lot of things that can cause a sudden loss of vision, some of which have a systemic origin and some of which have an origin within the eyeball itself. For example, things like a retinal detachment, may be just confined to the eye, but, if you have a blockage of a blood vessel in the back of the eye, that may be a clue to more, systemic conditions such as high blood pressure or diabetes or something like that.
Okay. So when you're looking at the retina and you talk about retinal detachment or you're talking about suddenly a blood vessel occluded, what are you seeing? What part of the anatomy is going on, and then what do you see in that anatomy?
So when I'm doing a retinal exam, often the patient is dilated. We make the pupil big with the eye drops, and through my tools in the office, I can view the inside of the eye. And as I'm viewing the inside of the eye, I'm viewing the back of the eye, so the sort of the inside of the ball of the eye. And the retina is the layer in the back of the eye. I can also see the optic nerve where that enters the back of the eye, and that provides sort of a glimpse into the brain. And then we have blood vessels, both arteries and veins, that come into and out of the eye through the area of the optic nerve that provide the retina its oxygen and nutrients it needs to be healthy. And within the retina, more specifically, looking at the macula or the fovea, the very center of the vision, we can examine that and look for any pathology as well.
Hmm. So let's talk about, go back to that retinal detachment. What would you see if the retina was detached?
Well, oftentimes people with a retinal detachment can present with, it can be a very dramatic exam. As I look in the eye, instead of seeing the retina adherent to the back of that ball, the eyeball, it's actually floating up towards me. And so I see it in 3D floating up towards me. And that tells me there's a tear in the retina and fluid has gotten through that tear underneath the retina is lifting the retina up.
Mm-hmm. Why does that happen?
That can happen for a number of reasons. Trauma can be one of the main reasons. Sometimes people that who are very nearsighted can be at a particular risk. There are certain
the genetic structure of your eyes such that it increases the torsional some kind of pressure or tension on the back of the eye, so the retina will just come off a little easier.
That's right. If you're mm-hmm. nearsighted and you have a longer eye, you're kind of stretching that retina out, yep. especially towards the periphery. And if you stretch that retina out, there may be some thinner areas.
Your eyeball's more like a football than it is.
That's right.
Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. And then you're seeing blood vessels in the eye. And so disease of blood vessels causes you to see what kinds of phenomenon in the back of the eye?
I can see pretty much things like diabetes would be mm-hmm. one of the main ones. The top three would be diabetes, hypertension. There can be changes in the blood vessels in the back of the eyes with hypertension as well. High cholesterol, you can see some changes with that as well.
Mm-hmm. So do you see actually a blood vessel that ruptures, or you can see a little thrombosis, which would be a clot of some sort in the vessel, or smaller blood vessels, larger blood vessels, the whole gamut of all of those things?
All of the above, anything and everything, especially when it comes to these top three conditions, especially uh-huh. diabetes.
Uh-huh.
When I say if we took diabetes, for example, mm-hmm. People may have heard of diabetic retinopathy, or, it's important to come see the eye doctor for a diabetes exam every year. And things you can see in the back of the eye with diabetes include, bleeding in the back of the eye. There can be leakage from the blood vessels in the back of the eye, so you can see fluid leakage. You can see little areas of infarct where there's lack of oxygen, and sometimes you can even get a blockage of a blood vessel in the back that can cause more bleeding.
And when you are looking at that, I think it's important for listeners to understand, that's not just localized to the eye. These are the same micro vascular changes that might be going on in your skin, which can lead to skin changes or changes in sensation in your feet or affect the kidney and so forth. Is that fair to say?
That's right. So as blood glucose levels increase, and very simplistically, they do over time, it can do damage to the vascular endothelium, and it can affect those fine little blood vessels of the eyes as they can pretty much anywhere else in the body.
Uh-huh. Endothelium is the inside lining cells of the inside of vessels.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're affected by abnormalities in glucose or other chemicals, and that leads to problems that can be seen in the back of the eye, which makes it kind of a, in a sense, I don't want to overstate it, a window into what's going on, particularly in the small vessels in the body. So a lot of diseases, for that reason alone, there's metabolic problems you can see.
That's right.
How about hypertension? What happens then?
Hypertension, it has similar findings. Now, sometimes the characteristic changes in the back of the eye may lead to actually a diagnosis of hypertension. And I've diagnosed hypertension in a couple of patients that had no idea they had it. What we call hypertensive retinopathy, which is hypertension that's affecting the retina, may range from a mild narrowing of the arteries in the back of the eyes to retinal hemorrhages or even swelling of the retina or swelling of the optic nerve even. It may also lead to blockages of major blood vessels of the retina, and the ensuing lack of oxygen can also lead to a secondary type of glaucoma that can be very difficult to manage as well. In addition, the coexistence of hypertension and diabetes may also increase your risk for diabetic retinopathy as well.
So when you look in and you made that diagnosis of hypertension, what was it that you saw specifically?
The most dramatic case I've seen was what we call stage 4 hypertensive retinopathy, and there was bleeding throughout the retina, along all of the blood vessels. There was swelling of the macula, the center of the vision, and there was even swelling of the optic nerve. Mm-hmm. The patient's vision had dropped quite dramatically. Instead of 20/20, they were seeing just basically hands in front of his face.
Mm-hmm.
And once we got the blood pressure under control, it can take many weeks to a few months for this to resolve, but he actually recovered some fairly decent vision afterwards.
Okay. All right. We are almost up to one of our breaks, but I do want to take a phone call that came in. Joy, you're on line one.
Hi. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how migraines affect vision, both for people that have migraines with pain and vision abnormalities or people that have just the aura headache.
Yeah, that's actually a really good question, because I see people that come in with these visual symptoms from migraines all the time. And, a classic migraine, people may have, say, these visual auras that they see, whether it's scintillating lights in the periphery of their vision or these wavy lines, or some people describe it as looking through water. And then after that starts to resolve, they have the ensuing migraine headache. However, there is an entity out there called an ocular migraine, where people actually have the visual auras of a migraine headache, but then, and that may last between 5 and 30 minutes, but then they don't get the ensuing migraine headache. Although afterwards they can have a little brain fog or feel a little off. And the symptoms can be very similar to things like retinal detachments. And so I do get a lot of emergency visits to my office to check for anything dangerous that may be happening in the eyes. And the thing with ocular migraines is I really don't see anything. Everything looks normal in the back of the eye. Now, there have been reports of during the episodes of an ocular migraine, ophthalmologists being able to see some of the blood vessels kind of spasming within the eye, called a retinal migraine. I haven't personally seen that myself, because I always seem to see people after their symptoms have gone away.
And are there any specific diet changes people can do to try to avoid the ocular migraines? With the regular migraines, they say, stay with some chocolate and red wine and things like that. Is there anything specific for ocular?
I think it's somewhat similar, because the origins of ocular migraines are somewhat similar. So I do talk to people about reducing stress, because sometimes stress can be a trigger for these headaches, but also, just as you've mentioned, red wine, chocolate, things like that. But it can be different for different people. So maybe keeping like a food diary might be a good idea if you're getting them a lot, and seeing if there's a pattern there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure, you're welcome.
Thanks for your call. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number again, 550 8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short one-minute break, and then we'll continue our discussion on what the eye exams can tell us about health and disease with Anchorage ophthalmologist Dr. Kelly Lorenz. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I am your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Kelly Lorenz. She's she's an ophthalmologist in Anchorage, and we are discussing what ophthalmologists can learn by just looking at a patient's eyes. They can tell about their health, and they can tell about a number of particular conditions, many of which are what we would call pathognomonic. That means that's only going to be seen in this particular kind of problems. If you have questions or comments relating to what we're talking about, here's how you can get to us over the next 40 minutes or so. You can email directly at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on a Monday evening, it's a taped recording, and we will not be able to answer your emails or phone calls. So any day now, if not already, depending on where you live, birch pollen is going to start flying around. It varies in amount each year, and people have variable amounts of symptoms, some pretty severe. When you look at an eye, can you tell whether this is an allergic eye? Can you tell whether this is a pollen-caused eye allergy or a dander or various and sundry questions about what you see when you see an eye that looks allergic?
Yeah, you know, an allergic eye, it has a certain look to it, and sometimes I can spot it across the room. And it, you're right, it's that time of year. As soon as the dust starts flying, they start trickling into my office, and I see more of this these allergies. And there's really two main types of things I see in my office. I see it like an atopic dermatitis, which is like an eczema around the eye. And chances are, if you have eczema around the eyelid, you probably have it elsewhere on your body too. And it's very common, often associated with allergy and hay fever. And there you see like a thickening and crusting of the lid, sometimes even loss of lashes and itching. And speaking of pathognomonic, itching is really the hallmark of allergy. Probably more what you're referring to, I also see allergic rhinoconjunctivitis, which is the most common form of ocular and nasal allergy, and it's a reaction to specific airborne antigens such as pollen. So, and there are two types of that. There's a seasonal allergic with the onset of, quote, hay fever in summer. The most common allergens are pollens in that case. And then the perennial allergic, which causes symptoms year-round with exacerbations in autumn when exposure to things like dust mites and fungal allergens is greatest, too. So what I see with an eye exam is I see redness, watering, itching, sneezing, nasal discharge. On the conjunctiva, or the outer layer of the eye, I see what's called a papillary reaction, or these little pinpoint little areas of irritation. And sometimes even swelling of the conjunctiva itself or the eyelids around the eye.
Yeah. So it can be fairly dramatic. The term I use is chemosis. You'll see with the whites of their eyes of individuals who are really affected, they get quite a bit of edema, and it can look pretty pretty scary, both frightening to look at and frightening to the patient, but is often not as bad looking or as dangerous as it might appear.
Yeah, the good thing about allergies is, and I've seen some really bad cases where once I put them on proper therapy, they come back looking like actually normal human beings.
And I was taught to look for something called cobblestoning. Is that what you were talking about with these pinpoint lesions?
Yeah, that's probably what we're talking about. You can have a kind of a, sometimes you can have like a giant, what we call giant papillary conjunctivitis, in which case your conjunctiva does take on the look of these little kind of cobblestones. You're right.
So again, these are fine. I don't know that chemosis happens in anything else. I mean, that. Do you think of chemosis happening with anything else, or is it almost always going to be allergy?
Chemosis can also, it can also happen with a couple other things, including trauma and minor irritations. But you're right, it's mostly with allergy.
Okay. What about, let's talk about perhaps other inflammatory disorders that can happen. A lot of people, I'm sure, have heard about lupus and maybe rheumatoid arthritis. We think of these as autoimmune problems, that which would also, I guess, we should throw in things like thyroid disease. Can you often tell from an exam which of these inflammatory autoimmune disorders are going on? Is it that specific? And then, if you don't mind telling us what you're seeing.
You're right. It can be very specific. Between something like Graves or rheumatoid arthritis or lupus can have a very, very different presentations, and I could tell by an eye exam, you know, what, you know, which one that would be.
What do you find for, well, so Graves' disease, just to make sure people understand, is a hyperthyroid thing. So what do you see there as opposed to maybe hypothyroid? How can you tell one or the other?
Yeah, so Graves' disease, it's an autoimmune condition that attacks the tissues around the eyes. It occurs 6 times more in women than it does in men, with a median age of around 43. So it tend to attacks kind of younger people. And it's not known for sure what initiates this immune response, but it can be associated maybe with various infections or traumatic or stressful events. But the ocular findings that are classic for Graves' disease would be eyelid retraction, which is the most common, where people have that. Sometimes people refer to it as a thyroid stare. When you look at somebody, you can see the whites of their eyes above and below their you know, the colored portion of their eyes. Sometimes their eyes can appear to be bulging out a little bit. There can be restriction of eye muscle movements that can lead to double vision. In extreme cases, there can even be compression of the optic nerve behind the eyes, and that may lead to, you know, more emergent therapy. One of the more common symptoms I see with people, though, is with the thyroid stare and the bulging eyes, you get a dry eye or a risk for corneal exposure that could potentially cause damage over time.
The corneal exposure happens, I'm guessing, since it's a bulging eye, that the lids don't close all the way over your eye at night in particular?
Exactly. And so we use aggressive lubrication with artificial tears and sometimes a thicker gel tear at nighttime. It does the trick for most people, actually.
Okay. And lupus. So this is systemic lupus erythematosus. Again, this is, I think of it as a inflammatory disorder of vessels in particular, so I would think the eye have some pretty interesting findings.
Yep, lupus definitely has some specific findings. Dry eye is common, as it is in many autoimmune conditions, but you can also get like a what's called a peripheral ulcerative keratitis, which means sort of it almost looks like an infection of the cornea around the sides of the cornea, although sometimes it's not an infectious cause. It's an autoimmune source. You can also have scleritis or inflammation of the white of the eye, and rarely you can also get, you talked about, a vasculitis or inflammation of the vasculature of the body. You can get that in the retina too. So when we look in the back of the eye, we could possibly see inflammation of the blood vessels in the back of the eye and the retina.
Let me remind listeners just one more time, if you've got questions or comments, there's a couple of ways you can get a hold of us. We're going to be here about another 30, 35 minutes. Our local number, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We talked about bulging eyes and lids not coming over and covering the eye, particularly with sleep and so forth, with hyperthyroid and particularly something called Graves' disease. Myasthenia is a different disorder. You mind mentioning what you might find and what myasthenia gravis is?
Yep, myasthenia gravis, that's an uncommon autoimmune disorder, but it's characterized by weakness and fatigability of voluntary muscles. So again, with a lot of autoimmune disorders, it affects females twice as much as males. Now, myasthenia gravis may be considered ocular or generalized, although ocular involvement or involvement of the eyes occurs in up to 90% of cases. Now, in this case, the antibodies sort of mediate damage to receptors on striated muscle or voluntary muscles, so it doesn't affect muscles such as the heart at all. Now, ocular findings, we can find what's called ptosis or drooping of the eyelids. Sometimes it can affect the muscles of the eyes, causing double vision or the inability to maintain gaze, especially up gaze, or even nystagmus, which is shaking of the eye.
And these are new changes that happen kind of suddenly. Somebody, if you take a look at people's pictures a lot, you may notice that we're not quite symmetrical often. One eyelid may be a little bit lower, one pupil may be slightly bigger. Most of the time, those don't cause any particular problems. But sudden changes are a lot more concerning?
Yeah, that's right. If people have had changes over time, then it may warrant some diagnostic testing to see if something new is happening there.
Any other inflammatory disorders or specific findings you can think of? I'm going to move on to infections, which are a big, big part of ophthalmology, I think.
Well, multiple sclerosis.
Ah.
Aha.
Good one.
That's a common one.
Yeah.
That may affect the eyes. So that's
And that can be a very difficult diagnosis. It can have various presentations, can be very relapsing, very... So is there a really... good way to diagnose multiple sclerosis on an eye exam?
Well, of course, the multiple sclerosis is diagnosed via a clinical diagnosis that's made by identifying different neurological symptoms that occur over time, and some of those neurological symptoms can involve the eye. Mm-hmm. One of the more common ones you may have heard of is called optic neuritis, and that can present very dramatically as dramatic vision loss over the course of hours or days. And we often treat that with high-dose steroids. The good news is most people regain full vision over time, but that can be a sign of optic neuritis, and we'll often order an MRI scan to look for other signs. There can also be things like leakage from the blood vessels in the retina. Sometimes people can have inflammation in the eye called uveitis. And there can also be some visual deficits if there are some lesions due to multiple sclerosis in the brain. As well, there can be eye motion disorders called internuclear ophthalmoplegia that can result in complete or partial paralysis of gaze as well.
Hmm. So that the movement of the eye then is affected? Is that what's
That's
happening?
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Interesting. Intracranial pressure is another thing that's on my – well, actually, let me back up just a second. You said optic neuritis, and you're seeing that. So that's a – I would like us to talk about that a little bit more. You're seeing the optic nerve as it enters the back of the brain. There's nowhere else in the body where we can look at a nerve directly. So in a sense, you can almost say we're looking at least an extension of the brain. So optic neuritis means to me inflammation of that neuron. What are you seeing there, and what's happening in your mind in that neuron, or in that optic nerve?
Well, in the case of somebody who may have MS that presents with optic neuritis, the vast majority of the cases, the inflammation actually occurs behind the optic nerve. So we don't see active swelling of the optic nerve, although it can happen in some atypical cases. So in this case, I don't see much of anything, but we do see some pupillary abnormalities, reduction of vision, reduction of color vision, some visual field deficits that lead us to a diagnosis of optic neuritis.
Okay. So sometimes after head trauma or other issues, which I can let you talk about, we might suddenly have an increase in pressure in our head. And that can be reflected in an ophthalmologic evaluation. What are you looking for? Why are doctors looking in the back of the eye of someone with a head injury or complaining of, for example, a sudden severe headaches?
Well, if we're looking for, oftentimes I'll get patients referred to my office to look for an increase in pressure inside the head, and that can be often reflected in the appearance of the optic nerve. You can get something called papilledema, or swelling of the optic nerve, which has a very characteristic appearance to it. There's, you know, instead of a nice round little donut-type structure, there's bulging of the optic nerve, there's kind of swelling around the optic nerve, kind of blurring its margins. Oftentimes there's hemorrhages around the optic nerve as well.
Mm-hmm. So again, what you're seeing is these small microvascular changes related to that pressure. So blood's having mm-hmm. trouble getting into the back of the eye. It's also having trouble getting out of the back of the
That's
eye.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And that leads to a distinct abnormality in that where the optic nerve comes in, and you can tell by looking at it that something's causing increased pressure inside the head.
Yeah, it's almost like somebody's trying to shove the optic nerve more into the eye, and it's mm-hmm. coming out at mm-hmm. you on exam.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller. I'd like to take that call right now. Mm-hmm. Wendy, you're on line one.
Thank you. I have a two-part question.
Uh-huh.
First of all, have there been any breakthroughs in assessing glare and its how it impairs nighttime driving mm-hmm. in seniors, I guess I would even further narrow it down. Mm-hmm. And then second thing, is there any promising treatment for that other than cataract surgery?
Well, actually there's not too much has changed in our assessment of glare over time. It's kind of difficult in clinic to mimic exactly what it's like to be driving at night in the rain with headlights coming at you, but we do have certain techniques that we use when assessing for glare. For example, when we refract somebody for glasses, you know, we have somebody look through that instrument called the phoropter, where that's the one where we say better one, better two, better one, better two. And then and we have you look up towards the letters, and we can assess glare by shining a light towards your eye and seeing how much that impairs your vision. And if that impairs your vision by a certain number of lines, we'll say, okay, well, glare must affect your vision by about this degree. Now, it's not, of course, a real life sort of assessment, but it's, you know, one of the best we have in clinic. Your second part of your question, oftentimes glare does come from cataracts. However, it can come from other things. Sometimes people that have a dry eye can experience glare when driving at night. And so I encourage people to put the vents in their car, instead of blowing right on their face, blow it towards their feet and use artificial tears. Sometimes people who have an advanced glaucoma can also experience significant glare, and so there are different techniques we can use to help with that. Some of my patients have used glasses with certain types of tints to help with glare, and people always ask me what color tint should I get? But I find that it's different for different people, so I have a hard time recommending a certain color tint, but you got to kind of find what might work the best for you. And that may take the edge off the glare, and if you're able to function that way with the glasses, if the glare is due to a cataract, it may not be time for cataract surgery.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, Wendy, thanks for your call. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection again. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Another one-minute break coming up, and then we'll come back and talk some more with Dr. Kelly Lorenz about what we see or what she sees, not necessarily me, on an eye exam. This is Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection, originating from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Again, my guest today, Anchorage ophthalmologist Dr. Kelly Lorenz, and what we're doing is we're talking about the things that they see, ophthalmologists, when they look at the eye, and what in particular it can tell about patients' health. Often a specific diagnosis can be seen, and often what they're seeing is a reflection of inflammation, infection, effects of hypertension, effects of cholesterol, effects of various disorders that are going on in the rest of the body. So it provides a true window into disease and health. If you have questions or comments, you can reach us locally at 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And the typical warning is if you're listening on Monday night between 8 and 9 p.m., you're really listening to a taped recording, and we won't be able to help you at that particular time. Did get an email, Dr. Lorenz, that says, what causes a drusen in the optic nerve, and how much of a concern is it?
You stumped me. I'm not sure exactly what causes drusen in the optic nerve. I think it's something we're mainly just it could be genetically predisposed to, but it's oftentimes an incidental finding, and 99.9% of the time, it's absolutely nothing to be concerned about, and it never causes any problems. On rare occasions, it may, and that it, because it's depending on what section of the optic nerve it's in, it may cause a small visual field defect that probably nobody, you know, the patient wouldn't notice. So I still don't think it's too much to worry about. I very rarely see any issues with it.
All right. So often it's, we're not sure why it's there, but often it's just one of those findings you get when you start looking and probably has no real concerns unless it's
That's right. Sometimes it can be mistaken for papilledema, as we discussed earlier, swelling of the optic nerve. And after you've seen a few swollen optic nerves, you can easily distinguish between optic nerve drusen and a swollen optic nerve.
Okay. Just so that I don't forget it, I'm going to get off the findings real quickly and ask you about myths and misconceptions. It's a common question I like to ask our guests, because there's so much misinformation. And so if I were to ask you, what are some common myths and misconceptions about the eye and health, you would say?
I got a lot of them here. I get these questions every single day, and I'm sure some of our callers will probably come up with ones that may or may not stump me. So if you think of one that I don't mention here, call in and see if I know it. So the first one I have is myth number one. There's nothing you can do about preventing vision loss. That's a lot of people think that their sight and their vision and their eyes, they're just up to fate. You know, they either see or, you know, they get unlucky and they don't see. But there's actually so much you can do to protect your eyesight out there. And from eating a healthy diet with plenty of fruits and vegetables and whole grains and not smoking, protecting your eyes from the sun, exercising, things like that, can all go such a long way to protecting your eyesight. The second myth I have is number two, you only need an eye exam if you're having problems. Now, that's a big myth, because there are plenty of things that could be happening in the back of the eye that you don't know about, such as glaucoma. It can be very silent, and you wouldn't know unless you had an eye exam. So it's important to get an eye exam every year or
so. And a glaucoma is an unusual amount of pressure in the glass.
That's right. And by and large, I think we discussed last time, sometimes there may be symptoms, but by and large, there's no symptoms to glaucoma, and you'd have no idea you have it until it's far too late. And I've seen some folks that way.
That's because you're just subtly losing, as I recall, peripheral vision, and you don't notice it. Is that true?
Yeah, most people can start losing vision in their far periphery first. Mm-hmm. It can be slow, insidious, and people can lose a good amount of vision before they realize anything's wrong.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yep. The next one I have is watching TV or reading in dim light can damage your eyes. And there are probably a lot of parents out there who are like, no, but it does not damage your eyes. Mm-hmm. So, this has been ingrained in me since I was a little kid, because my mom said it to me. And even though I know it doesn't damage your eyes, I've said it to my daughter. I just can't help it. So it's just, that's how ingrained some of these myths are.
There's been a theory that's been espoused, and I don't know how much research, I've never chased it, that we're spending more and more and more time indoors, and so that is a reason for why we're having more and more poor vision. What do you say to that question?
Yeah, you know, That's a good question. I'm not exactly sure how much truth there is to that. But okay. I think, you know, it's not going to hurt to get outside and just focus yep. in the distance for a yep. little while, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
The next one I have is staring at the sun is okay as long as you have sunglasses on. Well, I think we know probably from the eclipse earlier this year, there are plenty of warnings out there not to stare at the sun, even if you have sunglasses on. I've seen one case of solar retinopathy is what it's called, where someone actually literally burnt holes into their retinas and they were legally blind because they stared at the sun. So don't do that. This is one I get all the time. Using glasses will make my eyes dependent upon them. Mm-hmm. So I still have patients that don't want to wear glasses because they think they're going to make their eyes dependent upon them, but this is definitely not true. You either have a refractive error or you don't.
That gets me into the cause and effect, coincidence and causality. You know, I use the example every time I go to the barber, I seem to have less hair when I come back. I'm getting more and more bald, so it must be the going and getting my hair cut. But, the same thing happens with a lot of chronic diseases. If I take this medicine all the time and I keep having this chronic disease, it must be the medicine's making it worse. And that's not what's going on. It's actually the other way around.
That's right. Let's see here. Here's a good one. If I wear regular glasses, then I don't need to wear safety glasses when I'm chainsawing. That I see things fly around glasses all the time, and I've seen very, very severe ocular injuries from people not wearing safety glasses, I like safety goggles a little bit more because they cover all the sides.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm guilty of that, thinking if I wear my glasses, obviously. But you need something to keep things from coming in from the side, is what you're saying.
That's
or
right.
Top or the bottom.
You would be surprised what flies around and somehow magically goes around the sides and into somebody's eye.
Very good.
The last one I have is... Oh, the best thing for a black eye is to hold a raw steak over it. holding something colder, cold compress is a good idea, but I don't think I'd hold a raw piece of meat over my eye because the bacteria could cause more damage than good. That's okay. My last little bit of information there.
All right. So back to some problems and what we might see. We have a question about macular degeneration. Apparently it's pretty... common in this family's history, and the listener wants to know what you can do to prevent it. So let's talk about what you see in an exam, what the symptoms might be, and then what can be done to prevent macular degeneration.
That's a great question, because it was previously thought that macular degeneration was simply a condition confined to the eye, but there's a lot of argument these days that macular degeneration is a sign of a systemic condition. And so what can we do systemically to help prevent macular degeneration? Now, this happens to be the leading cause of blindness in the U.S. over the age of 65 and affects more than 10 million Americans, so it's so common. The exact mechanism is unknown, but we think genetic predisposition can play a role. It is age-related and occurs more in people who are older, like 75 and older, but it can happen at younger ages. Risk factors include increased age, a positive family history. Cigarette smoking is a big one, so not smoking is important. Having a light iris color, some of these things we can't really help. But hypertension, high cholesterol, cardiovascular disease, eating a diet high in saturated fats can increase your risk for macular degeneration, as well being overweight. So what happens with macular degeneration is that we have these deposits in the back of the eye called drusen that accumulate in the retina, along with atrophy of the photoreceptors in the retina. There are two main types of macular degeneration. There's dry, which is the collection of this drusen, and in wet, where we have little new blood vessels that form in the back of the eye and leak fluid or bleed in the back of the eye. And it's thought that inflammation and what we call oxidative stress to the eye and in the body as a whole could contribute to the development of this condition. So the question I get all the time in clinic is, what can we do to prevent or manage this condition? Because there's a lot of things that we can do. One thing is just getting regular eye exams so your eye doctor can follow it and look in the back of the eye. Oftentimes, we'll supply people with something called an Amsler grid. It's a grid that I encourage people to tape up to the refrigerators, because you look at it one eye at a time at about arm's length with your glasses on, and know where your baseline is with the grid, because oftentimes people with early macular degeneration can see the square grid look distorted or bent, or areas of it may be missing. An important thing is to know where your baseline is so you can detect changes, and if there's a change, call your eye doctor immediately. With dry macular degeneration, we've long recommended something called an eye vitamin, or an arid study eye vitamin. This is based upon a study that was done years ago with thousands of people who had a dry form, an intermediate dry form of macular degeneration. Half the people didn't take any supplementation, and half the people took this eye vitamin, and they found that people that took the eye vitamin had a somewhat slower progression of their macular degeneration. So that can be helpful, and you can buy those over the counter. Stopping smoking, as I discussed, would be very important. If you continue to smoke, then the macular degeneration can get a lot worse. Avoiding UV light, wearing sunglasses, eating a diet high in antioxidants, that means brightly colored fruits and vegetables and green leafy vegetables have been shown to help. Sometimes with the wet form of macular degeneration, patients need to see a retinal specialist, where they may get injections in the eye to help slow the macular degeneration. Interestingly, the macular pigment in the back of the eyes is entirely of dietary origin. So lutein and zeaxanthin are two phytonutrients that are found to help protect our retinas by building up this macular pigment. And lutein and zeaxanthin are found mostly in greens. And there was one study I read about, a dietary study where a cup of corn and a half cup of spinach per day built up the macular pigment density in patients over the course of 3 months. And in another study found that people eating 15 goji berries a day protects against the buildup of drusen in the back of the eye. So those are a couple different things that you can have to eat that might help slow down the macular degeneration.
Okay. Smoking is associated with a lot of disorders, and it causes vascular small vessel changes, can lead to heart disease and skin disease, and there are lots of things. So, and my mother had significant macular degeneration, was a long time smoker. We're beginning to see a significant decrease in some heart disease and so forth. And it's not clear to me yet, and I haven't really researched it, how much is going to be found to be related to the decrease in smoking that's going on, particularly for long periods of time. When I mention macular degeneration to you, do you think yourself as smoking as the principal risk, or do you think of it as just one of a number of things? You've mentioned a lot. I'm just curious as how you would rank these particular risks.
I think smoking has to be one of the top risks that we know about. All right. And so it's so difficult when I have patients who smoke to recommend dietary changes and exercise and things like that, because if you continue to smoke, the rest is just a drop in the bucket. Right. So the primary thing is, we really got to stop people from smoking. It does so much damage to so many organs, including the eye. And I have seen people smoke themselves blind, and it's really, really hard to see that.
All right. Juliana, you've been holding for a while. You're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I have glaucoma. And recently, and I see the changes in my eyes. I'm 78 now. Mm-hmm. My father was 78 when he went blind from glaucoma, and I'm built like him. I look like him, so I'm sure that the optic nerve. And I realize it's pressure on the optic nerve. But at any rate, there is a new product that came out that was announced on the national news. And I wonder how this is different from what I've been taking, because I have the world's best ophthalmologist. I adore him. I do. He's wonderful. But at any rate, I wonder how this is different than what I've been taking. And it was on national news, which is why I called him. He did prescribe it for me. How can this help us people who are really frightened? And I am frightened. My father went blind at 78. I'm 78. He lived till 86, and he lived blind those years.
Yeah.
I know. I don't want to go blind.
I know glaucoma can be a very scary diagnosis, but if you have an ophthalmologist that you see on a regular basis and you have a good relationship with that ophthalmologist, that's the number one thing that's going to help keep you from losing vision, because they're going to follow you very closely to make sure nothing changes. So my goal with my patients with glaucoma is that our goal is to keep people from losing any more vision. If they've lost some vision, we're not going to lose any more vision if you stick with me. And or with your ophthalmologist that you trust, of course. And the important thing is, you know, doing the work at home, putting in, if you're prescribed eye drops, to take your eye drops on a very regular basis and find a system for remembering to take your eye drops. There are a lot of new products out there, new potential products. I'm not sure exactly which one you might be talking about, but, you know, along with eye drops, there are different laser procedures and even surgeries to help with glaucoma. And we are looking at different ways of delivering eye drops. So maybe you might have, you know, they might have been talking about a new potential way to deliver an eye drop through, I don't know, like a contact lens or something like that. We don't have those out there just yet. But there are some new types of drops out on the market, too. They might have said, I'll have to look that up. I'm not sure which therapy they may have been talking about.
Well, it was called VY. I don't know, VZY something. I don't want to advertise this on the radio. But what he said was they put a new molecule in the one I'd been taking.
Ah, okay. And we are...
It was on national news, which is why I called him.
Ah, there are a couple new eye drops coming out this year that are probably... that might be what you're talking about, that are a new sort of delivery vehicle molecule within the drop where it may have better penetration in the eye and maybe more effective. So it may have been referring to that. So that's something to look into.
Thanks for your call, Juliana. Good luck. All right, Carolyn, you're on line one. We've just got a little over a minute. What can we do for you?
Well, not much in that time, but I noticed a lot of little kids looking to be about 5 years old wearing glasses. So mm-hmm. I asked around and found out that there's been an increase of about 18% in young children having to wear glasses. And it's a 3 to 5 year old, from 3 to 5, there is this narrow window of the eyeball being developed in such a way by the muscles of the eyeball that if they don't get that exercise far, near, and up close, and especially the far and medium range, they will be sentenced to a lifetime of glasses. Not all kids, obviously, but I was wondering if what there is to this, and also, is it a matter of us having to helicopter pilot our, you know, to watch our kids closer because we're afraid of things happening to them, and kids not being able to be free range running around in the tule weeds as we did for thousands of years.
I imagine there could be two reasons for that. One, maybe it is an excess of indoor activities and people need to get out and, like I said, focus in the distance and enjoy nature for a while, and that's going to be good. But also, it could be an increase in our ability to detect the need for glasses and treating the kids properly and with eye exams.
Thanks for your call, Carolyn. We're going to have to take a break here. Actually, more than that, we're going to have to get off the air. I want to thank Kelly Lorenz for being with us today. If you have more that you would like to discuss, you can continue that discussion on health and disease with the eye exam on KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org. Next week, Prentice Pemberton will return. The talk will be on postpartum depression. That'll be Monday, April 23rd at 2 p.m. Dave Waldron produced today's program, and he also was our audio engineer. Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.